I hope you can hear me.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so we were discussing Uraga Sutta, so let me share my screen. So we were discussing Uraga Sutta, and this is also coming in the Sutta Nipata, one of the interesting suttas. Actually, this is the very first sutta available in the Sutta Nipata. The whole theme is actually based on shedding of the worn out skin. Now, you know that one of the custom of the serpents are to shed out the worn out sting, worn out skin. So basically, time to time, they do that. And so that is one. Yeah. Now basically, so Buddha mentioned this as a simile throughout this sutta. So as again and again Buddha highlights, like a serpent shedding off the worn out skin, do this, abandon that, let it go this. So likewise he used this phrase repeatedly in this whole sutta. Now in the first sermon, actually, we discussed about the very first verse where Buddha highlights about the letting go of the anger. Uppaditam vineti kodham. So basically, that highlights removing the anger when it is arisen in the mind. And today, actually, we can go to the next verse, that is the second one. So that actually talks about the lust. So let me recite the verse. Yo raga mudachida asesang bisapuppamva saroruhang vigaiha so bhikkhu jahati ora parang urago jinnamiva tacham purana. Yo raga mudachida asesang, so one entirely cutting off raga, lust, so asesang without any remainder. So complete eradication of lust. How? Bisa puppangva saroruhang vigaiha. Like someone is plucking a lotus growing in a lake. So that means uprooting the whole lotus plant growing in a lake. So you know that there are people who are eating the lotus root, and so they are plucking the whole plant. So likewise, so if one is able to completely uproot lust, so then that bhikkhu gives up the here and the beyond. So bhikkhu jahati ora parang urago jinnam iva tacham purana. Like a serpent sheds its old worn out skin. Now as you can see here, the point is to remove lust, raga. Now this is not a easy thing in a way. Sometimes you can simply say kamachanda is one of the hindrance. So when you are in the first jhana, it is not there. And even before that, if you are able to concentrate your mind, so kamachanda, the sensual desire, is abandoned. But still, once you come out of the jhana and once some more time is spent, then again kamachanda may appear in the mind. So basically, uprooting kamachanda is the point highlighted in this particular verse. It is not a kind of a temporary subsiding of kamachanda. Temporary subsiding of lust is not the point highlighted here, rather complete uprooting of kamachanda. Now, raga, dosa, moha are the three main unwholesome roots. And raga is particularly that we can say in different ways. It could be lust, it could be greed, it could be kind of a desire. So likewise, many forms of craving is there. So if we are attached to certain, say, rupa, different kinds of sights, that we can call as ruparaga. And then if we are attached to certain kind of sounds, maybe music, then we have sort of saddaraga. And when we have different attachments, desires towards some fragrances, then we have the gandharaga. And when we have certain greediness, attachment towards certain delicious food, then we have rasaraga. And when we are attached to certain sensations, we have the pottabharaga. And on top of that, we have certain, now these, what we have already discussed, are what we call sometimes as pancha kama. We are the five kinds of sensual cords to which we all are quite bounded with. And this is what the whole sensual world is trying to offer, and we are trying to get as much as possible. And through the senses, through the ears, through the eyes, through the ears, through the nose, through the tongue and through the body, so these five faculties we are using to gratify these senses by giving food, either various sights to the eyes, sounds to the ears, odors to the nose, taste to the tongue, and tactile sensations to the body. So this is the whole task what we are doing. So in the whole sensuous world, so this is very much the whole business. So if you consider the whole economic system, so it is nothing but satisfying these five senses. So our whole economic system, whole society, very much is attuned, very much focused to satisfy these five senses. And more we are able to satisfy it, then we call that we are quite wealthy and we are in the first world and we are quite rich, because we can satisfy the five senses to the fullest. Then we call ourselves as rich people. And we are satisfied people. I don't know, actually we can't say we are satisfied, but this is what we consider as the most important thing to do. Satisfy five senses. But on the other hand, the more we satisfy, more we try to satisfy, we can recognize certain kind of a pollution happening in the mind. So that is another area that we can think of, because in order to satisfy the eyes, actually we are looking at various sights, but actually eyes are not the one ultimately going to consume all these various sights, but ultimately they are being consumed by the mind. And similarly, when we are listening music, our ears are simply kind of an apparatus which simply sends various sound waves, but the mind is the one going to enjoy it, going to consume that sound. Similarly, likewise, when we are considering these five senses, so different apparatus we have to recognize these external objects, and ultimately mind is the one going to consume all these. So among these, what happened to the mind is sometimes when we are going through some, happy feeling. So then immediately we have a kind of a desire to those happy feelings. Whenever happy feelings are there, immediately some sort of craving arises. Immediately some sort of desire arises. And ultimately going to have lust towards that. Now the mind is fairly bounded, attached to it. And mind is bounded, attached to it, and again thinking about it. Suppose that you see someone, and his or her sight is quite beautiful, pleasing, and so I am now looking at him, looking at her again and again, because I am getting a kind of pleasing feeling about when I am looking at. Again and again now I am looking, more and more I am thinking, more and more I am proliferating, I am fabricating. So I am adding certain parts from my own side as well. I have certain prejudices, I have certain likes and dislikes, my own value judgments. Now I am adding those things onto the experience, and accordingly, so I am getting my mind more lustful. Now, as we are further thinking, so my mind is bent towards that particular way of thinking. Now actually, suppose at the beginning you didn't have any kind of a bias attitude in the mind. Assume that the mind was fairly unbiased, kind of a neutral. But more we think about a particular person, more we think about something which we like again and again, again and again for several days, now actually we don't need to even motivate the mind to think about it. Now mind is conditioned to think about it. Now mind is fairly inclined towards that object, inclined towards that person. And so now mind is fully occupied with that person, various thoughts about him, various thoughts about her. So mind is colored by this sensual desire. So Buddha give a kind of a simile that sensual desire is very much like being kind of in debt. So when someone is in debt, so he has some kind of a burden because he has to pay off the bill, he has to pay off the rent or pay off the loan. So his mind is somewhat experiencing some sort of a burdened atmosphere because he feels that I am in debt to a particular person. Now Sri Lanka is in debt to the whole world, I mean with a huge amount. So likewise, so Buddha mentioned, so this sensuous desire, when one have this sensual desire, so he is burdened with this kind of a situation. But on the other hand, when sensual desire is away, so it is very much like the freedom from lust, freedom from sensual desire, freedom from the debt. So he feels kind of a lightness. Now, how to abandon lust? Now, this is very much like something that we need to discuss. So Buddha highlights that you can't abandon lust simply through the body. And you can't abandon lust simply by the words. But you can abandon lust by repeatedly observing it wisely. Rāgo bhikkave na kāyena pahātabbo na vācāya paññāya disvādisvā pahātabba. So Buddha mentioned, this lust, monks, only can be abandoned by wisely seeing it, wisely reflecting it. So, and on the other hand, this lust is not easy to abandon because it has some sort of an enticement, it has some sort of a enjoyment. Now, if you consider anger, anger on the other hand has a kind of a burning effect. So, if you have some amount of burning effect, then you are trying to abandon it quickly. But on the other hand, when mind becomes lustful, it has kind of an enjoyment. So if we are attached to that enjoyment, if we are trying to enjoy lust, enjoy the lustful feeling, then we are not worried to quickly abandon it. So as a result of that, what we do is mostly to feed the lust, to keep it, to feed it, enjoy it. So then it starts to grow. It starts to even overwhelm us. So that way we are actually developing lust, improving lust, and on the other hand we are improving raga anusaya. So these lustful thoughts are very much like a kind of a latent tendency in the mind. It is, even though probably right now our minds are not filled with lust, so the seed of lust is included in our mind. It is very much inherent in our mind. So the seed of lust is available. It is available as a latent tendency, hidden tendency. Whenever a particular object comes to our visual field, to our conscious field, then immediately that lustful seed going to get activated. And then again the mind becomes lustful. So therefore we are in a little difficult situation. Even though right now the mind is not lustful, still the potential is there, the danger is there, the vulnerability is there. So therefore Buddha mentioned, even one can have, I mean, when consider all the other different kinds of forms, say when a man is considered, so he can see different forms. Say it could be a building, it could be a car, it could be money, it could be fruits, it could be vegetables, it could be this and that. Among these various forms, Buddha mentioned, for a man, to a man, a woman's form is the most enticing, most tantalizing, most sensuous, most intoxicating, captivating, infatuating. Form is nothing but the form of a woman. And the opposite also mentioned. For a woman, that is the man's form, is the one most enticing, most sensuous, most tantalizing form. And similarly with the mention for a man, the sound of a woman, say she is talking and she is singing, she is murmuring, and all that sound of a woman is the one most tantalizing, most sensuous, most intoxicating kind of a sound to a man. The opposite also mentioned. To a woman you can think, accordingly you can think. So on the other hand, Buddha further mentioned, even the odor of a woman is the most sensuous, intoxicating, captivating, infatuating odor to a man. Even the taste Buddha mentioned, and even the sensation, touching, is also mentioned. To a man, a woman's touching, a woman's touch is the most sensuous, tantalizing, intoxicating, captivating, infatuating sensation is nothing but the woman's touch. So you can see actually the whole sansaric journey is based on this kind of a system. So we are sometimes as youths, as in our say our youthhood, so we get attached to someone and we are thinking about him, thinking about her, and we are falling in love, and so we are thinking. So ultimately we can't live without her, we can't live without him. So we actually being bound to that particular person. Now our mind is very much like conditioned, and whole mind is captivated. Whole mind is very much infatuated. And suppose now we get married and then spend some time and several years, now we have children. And probably now assume that we become somewhat neutralized now. Now probably if we look back what has happened say 10-20 years ago during our youthhood, during our campus years, so what has happened? So at that time probably we can now recognize, so mind was fairly infatuated. So our mind was fairly captivated by those kinds of thoughts, lustful thoughts, various kind of fantasies, dreaming, all sort of things. So at that time, but we couldn't get understood that. At that time we were not in a position to understand that, and we thought that this is the best thing to do. I am falling in love, so this is a true love. I want to marry her, so I am this and that. So we were thinking and we are very much like driven by that. So therefore, so this lustful thought is something we become fairly victimized. We become kind of a slave to this lust. And because of its enjoyment, so we can't immediately get rid of it, and we again and again burn with lust. And again and again, again feeding lust. The raga anuse, we are feeding, we are improving. More and more we are enjoying, more and more we are feeding. More and more we are blindly enjoying the lustful thoughts, and accordingly assume that we go through the whole thing, then we are very much like feeding this lustful thought. So this is the situation that we were doing for long, long time, not even in this very life, but even the whole past we were doing this. So that is why this quality is very much like an inherent quality to our mind. It's a kind of a habit, very much deeply rooted in our mind. So even though right now the mind is free from lust, still it is deeply rooted. In the surface it is not visible, but the mind still has some deeply rooted tendency towards lust. So whenever a sensuous object is, appealing object is visible, then again immediately that hidden lust become active. So how to overcome that? So that is the question that we as practitioners have. And it's a kind of a, Buddha mentioned, it's a kind of a gradual process. So you can't immediately quickly take it out. So kind of a gradually gradually we need to remove it. Even a Sotapanna still has lust. But he may not go through certain sexual misconduct because of lust, because that gravity he has removed. So he may not incur, he may not conduct kind of a lustful activity which is taking him to the hell realm. So some kind of a weakening of lust has happened into that level. But fair amount of weakening has happened when one becomes a Sakadagami, once returner. And when it consider the sensuous world, the complete abandonment of the sensuous world-related lust is abandoned only when one becomes an Anagami, non-returner. And still some kind of a deeply rooted attachment or desire is available to the other realms that sometimes we call as Ruparaga, Aruparaga. And that would be only abandoned when one becomes an Arahant. So you can see it's a kind of a ongoing process. So our minds are fairly conditioned, deeply conditioned, deeply rooted with this lust. So actually during our practice, say in our early stages of practice, we can't actually face to face fight with lust, because our kama chanda is very high, sensual desire is very high, all the other hindrances are also very powerful, so we can't fight with it. So what we do actually is use certain other mechanisms like asubha bhavana, recognizing the loathsomeness of the body, to temporarily subside lust. So we are not going to answer the whole thing, rather we are keeping it aside. Temporarily we are subsiding lust using the opposite. So we understand the loathsomeness of the body. We do a little bit of asubha bhavana, understand the unattractive nature of various body parts. So when we do that, a certain amount of lust already arisen can subside. But that is not the proper answer. Anyway, as we continue to develop mindfulness, as we continue to develop kaya anupassana particularly, so then fair amount of understanding happens about the body, see the body as various body parts, it is not a kind of a compact thing, and again we recognize its operation in terms of various elements. Now fair amount of understanding about the body happens, and say you continue your practice, go through even Vedana Anupassana, we recognize various feelings. And when you reach Sitta Anupassana, now you are coming to a different paradigm where even lust you can look at objectively. Now so far we were thinking that lust is really a troublemaker and I need to abandon it, I have to fight with it. So likewise I had kind of an attitude. But now when we reach Sitta Anupassana, actually we are able to look at lust objectively. It is no more my lust, but it is lust. So it's a very interesting paradigm shift in our meditative life. And at that time, whenever lustful thought is there, so we can recognize this as a lustful thought. Previously we couldn't, we simply become quickly victimized to lustful thought. We immediately think about her. We immediately think about what imaginary, whatever it is. So we are quite helpless. But right now, when mind becomes lustful, we can step back from it. We can go out of that lustful thought and we can objectively look at it. So it's a very interesting advance or kind of an advancement in our practice where we can look at lust as lust. Lustful thought as lustful thought, or lustful mind as lustful mind. And again, when mind become free from lust, again we can recognize, okay, now lust is no more there. Now mind is somewhat free from lust. So that is also possible to recognize. So as we continue the practice, now it is not difficult to understand when mind become lustful. And it is knowingly, if we are supporting lust, if we do, we may do it knowingly. Because this urge of lust is so strong, probably we understand now mind become lustful and I can stop it, but the power is so powerful, the urge is so powerful, so we allow it to overwhelm. So we become victimized, but still knowingly. But later, as we continue the practice, so we are not allowing lust to go to that far. So whenever lust is there, at its early stages, we can recognize. And if we give more prominence to maintain a purified mind, more cleansed mind, unattached mind, or to a pure mind, then rather than allowing the mind to overwhelm by lust, if we are more bent towards the purity of the mind, calmness of the mind, non-burning state of the mind, then we quickly be mindful about this lustful thought now going arising, and as a result of that we stop supporting it. As a result of that, now that lustful thought quickly fades away. Now again mind becomes quite neutral, unagitated, not burning. And as we move forward in Dhammanupassana, Buddha even mentioned the very first lustful thought one can recognize. And as a result of that, he is not feeding it, he is not becoming a victim to it. So he objectively look at it. And then it quickly fades away, and then the yogi may understand now mind does not associate any lust at all. Uppannassa kamachandassa pahino hoti tancha pajanati. So when that sensuous desire has abandoned, it has gone away, passed away, so the yogi know, okay, there is no lust available right now. So likewise Buddha mentioned, so whenever again and again lust arise in the mind, one has to look at it. One has to be aware of it. One has to know it. One has to recognize it as lustful thought, as a kind of a tendency available in the mind. So one has to do a kind of honest reflection. And once one is doing it, and again not feeding it, not fertilizing it, then lust alone doesn't have that strength or capacity to grow by itself, and then it slowly fades away. Again and again one has to do it. So then Buddha mentioned, slowly this lust is become weaker and weaker. And that is why he highlights, you can't do it simply by the body. You can't do it simply by words. Rather you need to wisely reflect. You need to know it whenever it arises. At that very moment you have to be quite vigilant, be aware of lust when it is available, and without promoting it, without feeding it, you need to slowly be mindful about it and let it go. So this way Buddha mentioned, if one is able to abandon lust like a person who is uprooting this lotus available in a pond, available in a lake, so then I call him is like a serpent who has abandoned the worn out skin. So with that I like to conclude today's Dhamma sermon. Now I like to open the session for questions. I hardly can hear you. Maybe you can talk a little louder.
Okay. I hope clear now.
Yeah. Okay.
We have 4 questions. Start with the mindful walking. Dear Venerable Sir, this question is about checking the status of the mind after practicing mindfulness and especially after a walking session. I have seen in general instructions of reflection writing, we are asked to observe the status of the mind after the practice. I have heard some reports highlighting feeling relaxed, feeling content, etc. Is this related to the status of mind observation? Appreciate if Venerable can give more details about how one should evaluate the status of the mind during reflections on the practice.
No, actually, we have to do a kind of a reflection time to time. So this is related even at our, say, early stages, even the middle stages, or even at the manupassana, cittanupassana stages, because it's a kind of an ongoing reflection. Say, for example, say you are just a beginner. So, and as you know, if you feel that our mind is overwhelmed by lust and overwhelmed by anger, mind is quite restless and filled with various doubts. So that means our mind is fairly vulnerable, fairly captivated by various hindrances. So we need to have a kind of an honest reflection. Say then you do take certain antidotes, like say you do asubha bhavana, you do metta bhavana. So likewise you do certain such activities so that mind becomes somewhat settled. But it's a kind of a temporary settlement, temporary calmness. And say you are now practicing anapanasati. So as you are continuing, again and again you have to do a kind of a reflection whether to understand whether mind is becoming more mindful, whether mind is becoming more concentrated. Is the restlessness become less and mind become focused, unagitated. So likewise, kind of an ongoing reflection has to happen. You are assessing yourself. Say as you continue, suppose now you reach some kind of a calmness, mind is somewhat tamed now. So at that time, because of that ongoing reflection, you need to understand, okay, I don't need to put lot of effort now because now mind is somewhat settled. If I put too much effort, then my mind may not continue to further concentrate. So in order for the mind to concentrate, I need to maintain only the necessary amount of effort. So if I am putting too much effort, then it is harmful at this level. So now you take that reflection, and as a result of that, you are reducing your effort, allowing the mind to settle, calm down, concentrate. Say you are reaching that state, and then you do this proper balancing, and assume that you become fairly concentrated. Your mind is fairly concentrated now. So then probably you can observe various phenomena available in the body, and all the, if you are doing anapanasati, what are the states now going to arise? Are there any kind of, say, happy feelings arise? Are there any kind of waves-like feelings arise? Rupture arise? So likewise, it's a kind of a observation of the mind, have a kind of a reflection of the mind. It's a type of an ongoing process, time to time you need to do, and accordingly you have to take the necessary action. And even when you reach cittanupassana, so that is where this activity is more prominent. So you reflect the mind, observe the mind from the beginning, from the morning to the end, towards the night. From the very moment that you wake up to the very moment that you go to sleep. So it's a kind of an ongoing process. So therefore, reflection about the mind is one of the very important tasks. And it becomes kind of a habit later, and you don't need to even purposely do, but it's become a kind of a activity which is very much kind of an inherent skill of the yogi.
Question number 2 of 5. General question. Dear Bhante, last week there was a question about continuing on observing the thoughts, and your reply was to observe relative status of stressfulness in the mind, olarika, and observe formations by mind making, sankata. Bhante mentioned about the Indriya Bhavana Sutta and the 3 methods a practitioner can use to develop mindfulness on thoughts. It will be really helpful if Bhante can explain these 3 again, as most of us are novices in observing the mind. With metta, that's the end of the question.
Yeah, actually, Indriya Bhavana Sutta is a very interesting sutta. This is the last sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. So, if you like, you can refer it. So, Buddha mentioned to the typical vipassana practitioners, so look at the mind whenever it grasps something. Now, actually, to come to this level, still you can't become simply a novice. You need to have some kind of experience related to the mindfulness practice. And there again, you should experience some kind of unattached state of mind. So that itself is required some kind of practice. Because you can't have an unattached state of mind, anicitta state of mind immediately. So you require a fair amount of practice to reach this. Suppose you reach it. Suppose that you are able to have a mind which is free from any object. It is objectless. And what the quality, if you consider the feeling tone of the quality, is nothing but the equanimity. Because there is nothing to associate, there is no object to attach. So the inherent quality of the inherent feeling tone of the mind is the equanimity. So Buddha mentioned this equanimity is more valuable, more precious, more sublime than being agitated, than being in an agitated state of mind. Now he is explaining the whole process. Say for example, you are observing or you are simply seeing something or someone, and if that person is a pleasing, likable person, then immediately mind become lustful, as we discussed today, lustful. Now Buddha advised, don't allow this lustful state to continue. See how it is little kind of burdened. It is somewhat kind of a gross state compared to the previous neutral, unattached state. Now, you have to have some sort of a reference, kind of an experience about that unattached, equanimous state to do this comparison. So then only Buddha mentioned, okay, now you got to go back to that neutral, simplified, unattached, unstressful, unburdened, that previous mental state, you just have to quickly go back, revert back. Don't be in this more gross, vulnerable, lustful, burning, burdened state. It is harmful. You got to return back to that previous unharmful, say, free, unattached, equanimous state. Similarly, Buddha mentioned, assume that you see someone and as a result of that, again, mind become angry. So don't be in this angry state of mind. It is more gross compared to that previous unattached, simplified state of mind. So quickly return back to that unattached, simplified, equanimous state of mind. So therefore, one technique Buddha highlights is to recognize this burdensome or gross state of the newly arisen agitated state of mind. It could be a lustful state, it could be angry state, it could be sort of anxiety, it could be whatever it is. It's a new state is fairly sort of burdened with grasping, burdened with attaching with something. So you recognize this burdensome feeling. It is kind of a gross. Previously, you were in a very calm, serene type of a very neutral state, which is more simple, lighter in feeling. So that is what Buddha mentioned is more healthy. If you consider the healthy state of mind, that neutral state of mind is more healthier. So try to maintain that. So whenever mind become agitated, due to lust, due to anger, due to restlessness, whatever it is, then don't be here in this agitated state. Return back to that healthy state of mind. And the second method Buddha highlights is to understand the constructed nature of this new state. Because mind may not become lustful immediately. There's a kind of a constructive process happen within the mind. It happens quickly, but if we are quite vigilant, we can understand how we were weaving thoughts, constructing thoughts in order to make the mind lustful. Say for example, if you have seen someone, immediately you are not seeing as a person. What we see is a kind of a mental, kind of a light beam, and it makes a kind of an image in the eye, and to which we give some value, and then we recognize this as a kind of an image, and then we compare it with our previous experiences, and then we map it, and we give a name, okay, this is her, this is him, and we give a name, we give a relationship to that, and then we personify that. This is a person now. No more mental image, but now it is a person. And this person is someone that I like, someone that I love. Now I am constructing various thoughts on top of that. Now my mind become lustful. Now my mind become agitated. Now my mind become elated or angry or whatever it is. So you can recognize this constructed nature. Actually, at the very fundamental, primary level, very subtle actions are there. On top of that, we do various constructions. We do various additions, multiplications. So this constructed nature, Buddha asks us to recognize. So if we are seeing that constructed nature, then actually we are able to deconstruct. We understood that how many things we added by our hand. We put a lot of things from our side. We add a lot of preconceived ideas, our prejudices, whatever it is. So when we recognize that, so the whole thing become disentangled, unentangled. And we can revert back to that simplified state. And the third method Buddha highlights is to recognize the dependent arising nature of this newly constructed stage. So it's very much like, say, when you are seeing something through the eye, so the eye and the form comes together and the eye consciousness arises, and then the contact arises. As a result of that, kind of a feeling arises, and the feeling causes kind of a craving, kind of tanha. And as a result of that, mind again and again look at that particular person, that particular sight, again and again, more and more craving arise. We are supporting it. Ultimately, mind go and grasp it. So this is a kind of a causal reaction happens in this whole process. And there Buddha mentioned to recognize this causal reaction, the cause and effect relationship. That also help us to deconstruct the whole process. So, olarika, sankata, paticisamuppanna. So, these are the three methods Buddha highlights. To a typical practitioner, a vipassana practitioner, to utilize during this whole process. And on the other hand, to a trainee, suppose that you are doing it for a long time and now you can quickly return back to the unattached state of mind, anicitta state of mind. And there are now you are gaining some sort of expectancy to do it quickly. Say your mind become agitated, but quickly you can return back to that unattached state of mind. And Buddha mentioned a very interesting point to a trainee, to a sotapanna, sakadagami, to ananagami. So there Buddha mentioned that you don't need to struggle with all these different methods. Rather, you can simply warn the mind. You can simply have kind of a shamefulness of what mind is doing, because you have already seen the constructed nature, you have already seen the conditioned nature, you have seen the impermanent nature of all these constructs, how suffering they are and how non-self they are. So you have already gained a fair amount of wisdom, but still mind is doing it. Still mind go and grasp, but you are not very much approving it. You are being shameful about what mind is doing. Attiyati harayati jiguchati. So you are become somewhat ashamed of what mind is doing. Why this fellow is still doing it? So that kind of a shameful attitude, Buddha mentioned, is enough for a trainee to return back to that unagitated, unattached, non-grasping state of mind. Yeah.
Question number 4 of 7. This is just a connected question to what we just talked about. So it's a general question. It says, Bhante, you mentioned a word called olarika. What does that mean with metta?
Means gross. Yeah, olarika means gross. Now, when you consider the mind in a very subtle state, unattached, non-grasping, so that's a very refined state. But when mind is attached, when mind is burdened, when mind is grasping something, that is a gross state. That is an olarika state. Previously, we were in a refined state, but now this grasping state is comparatively gross. That is what we call as olarika.
Next question is question number 4 of 7. It's a Dhamma Saman question. Dear Bhante, can you relate Ashvada, Adinava and Nisarana to today's Dhamma sermon and explain? We have heard this as one of the prominent teachings and a practical one to our situation. With metta, that's the end of the question.
Yeah, now if you consider the Ashvada, that is where we get the gratification. Say for example, when we see as a man, say as a young person, say when if he's a male, so if he see a female, an attractive person, then there's a kind of a happiness, enticing, enjoyment that he may gain. So this is true to sights, this is true to sounds, smells, tastes, sensations. So all these five sensual objects provide that kind of a satisfaction, that kind of a gratification. So that is the aswada side, the gratification side. But on the other hand, the adinava is where this is short-lived and you can't depend on. And whatever we like, some others also like. So we have to compete each other. We have to have various troubles. So we have to go through a lot of issues. We have to protect the person. We have to protect the loved ones. We have to protect the wealth. And therefore, we are going through a lot of suffering when we are doing that. And on top of that, all these what we like, all these what we want are going through this impermanent nature. They are subjected to impermanence. So even though we want that particular person not to change, but internally there is no such intrinsic capacity to maintain that state as it is. Intrinsically everything is changing. Everything is subjected to inconstant nature. Everything is changing it's going through in momentary changing. And again, when things are momentarily changing, again and again changing, each and every moment things are changing. So it is very much like oppressed by changing, oppressed by this impermanent nature. So that is what we call as a suffering, unsatisfactoriness. So you can't have, therefore, kind of a lasting happiness, lasting satisfaction from this, whatever it is, which is oppressed by impermanent nature. And on the other hand, this whole process happens out of our control, without our control. When you can request the other person not to change, but he or she, herself, himself doesn't have the capacity. It is beyond herself, it's beyond himself. So everything's very much like going through this non-self situation, and the conditions happen due to their own causes and conditions, onto which that we don't have much of a control. So therefore, things are happening according to their own agenda. So we are out of control, very much like that. So this is what we call as the adinava, where we understand the kind of inherent impermanent nature, unsatisfactory nature, and the non-self nature of all these conditioned phenomena. Now, nisarana is the complete giving it up, letting go, abandonment, and to finding out a refuge without being attached to these conditioned phenomena, how to have a release of the mind, how to have some sort of a freedom of the mind. So this freedom is what we call as the nisarana. So there the mind has to recognize kind of a mind state which doesn't associate on any of these constructed natures. Maybe not associating sounds, not associating say smells, taste, sensations, forms, thoughts. So any of the constructed objects is not associated. Everything is abandoned. So mind basically has abandoned all these conditioned phenomena and has become free from all these. So this, what we call in this anisita anupadana, unassociated, unattached, non-grasping state of mind, is what we can call as the nisarana, where you are able to recognize a kind of a state of mind which doesn't associate all these conditioned phenomena. So those conditioned phenomena are abandoned now, relinquished now, and that is the Nissarana. So as you have mentioned, so explaining Dhamma according to these three stages, understanding the asada, the gratification part, and knowing the consequences, that is the adinava part, and knowing the Nissarana, the relinquishment, the refuge part, is very interesting. Yes.
Question number 5. This is a general question. Dear Bhante, I suffered severe inflammation of my left shoulder in the latter months of last year. The condition had caused the joints to accumulate fluid and the surrounding muscles and tendons were all swollen as viewed in the scans. The clinicians could not find a cause for it. The pain was excruciating and the standard didn't seem to help. I'm thinking the analysis. In this occasion, unlike in the past, as I was versed in mindfulness meditation, I was able to focus my attention on my breath, the rest of the body excluding the painful shoulder, or bring my attention to the sound of silence. I could then observe the pain in the shoulder remotely from the vantages of those points of focus without emotion or proliferation of thought. I developed the ability, or did it come spontaneously, to observe the faint fragments into a burning sensation, a coolness, a tingling, and then vanish. I didn't have to resort to strong painkillers, such as codeine-based drugs. The control of pain and other afflictions by mindfulness is mentioned in Western medication over the last few decades, but not exactly in the manner I described. I would be grateful for your explanation of my experience as to whether my conclusions are valid. I am very grateful to you for your weekly teachings on meditation techniques and the teaching that follows. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, I think someone else also has put the same, very much like similar question. I can't remember whether the same person. So, I mean, whenever the body is going through this kind of an excruciating pain, so if we are able to look at it objectively, so that is the best thing we can do. But on the other hand, what typically happens is when the body is in a kind of a severe pain, so we are adding a mental pain on top of it. So that is where we go wrong. That is where we double the pain or triple the pain. That is what Buddha mentioned. So the bodily pain is unavoidable. So we don't know, I mean, even though we are trying to protect the body, take care of the body, so due to this various reasons, causes, so body may go through various pains. But when body is going through such pain, how about avoiding mind become painful? How about avoiding kind of a mind-made pain? So that is where the Dhamma helps. That is where the practice helps, actually. Before our body become painful, so if we are able to practice kind of a skill to look at things objectively. Now say for example, you are observing say breaths as an object. It's not that I am breathing, I am doing well or something like that. Rather, body is breathing, say I am observing. So I am an outsider. Body is breathing. Say body is going through various bodily postures. Now I am observing. Say body has various sensations, rising and falling and various other sensations, and I can observe like an outsider. So similarly, body is going through certain kinds of feelings, maybe even painful feelings. Still I can observe it, as you have mentioned, at a different vantage point. So I'm observing these pains. So that actually helps us to have a kind of a separation from the experience and objectively look at it. So that helps to avoid the mental pain. So that is where Buddha actually highlights even to what we call the not another pindika, what's that? Nakulapita. To him, that Nakulapita actually come as a kind of an old person to meet the Buddha. And he mentioned, my body is really weak now, it is quite suffering, it is going through various illnesses. So this is how I am going through it now. So once it is explained to Buddha, Buddha mentioned, yes, that is the situation. But now, Nakula, now the point is how to maintain a healthy mind even when the body is diseased, even when the body is ill. So that is the interesting point that Buddha is highlighting. Yeah.
Question number 6 of 7. So this is a general question. It's just a sent here. Dear Bhante, how can I forgive myself for using harsh speech or comfort myself when I cry that sometimes tend to occur following my meditation sitting? Is this a sign that I'm doing too much meditation? That's the
end. Can you repeat the question? Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, so there are two things. How can I forgive myself for using harsh speech or comfort myself when I cry? And she says those things are happening, tend to occur following a meditation sitting session. Is this a sign that I'm doing too much meditation? Is the question.
Actually, too much meditation, how to produce harsh speech? It can actually, now on the other hand, we can interpret it like this. So you may have too much expectations. So if you are having too much expectations and therefore you are doing too much meditation, expecting things to happen quickly, but when things are not happening quickly, so your mind become agitated, you become angry, now we are using harsh speech. So that is, that can happen, by the way. But on the other hand, when you are crying, say, I don't know, you are crying for the same reason that you are not getting the quick results. So you are crying, you become upset. So if you are crying like that, so then actually it's a matter of changing your sort of the attitude. So you can check, I mean, doing meditation for a long time or spending more time dedicating yourself is a good thing. I'm not criticizing that. But using harsh speech after that, or you become agitated after meditation, indicates some sort of wrongdoing or some sort of mishap, some sort of a mistake that you were doing during the meditation. So if you are getting kind of a, if you are using harsh words and you become somewhat agitated after the meditation, that indicates something is wrong in your way of meditation. Yeah. So you need to correct that. So when you are sitting, just have a very relaxed mind. Don't expect anything. Just do the daily course. That's all.
Thank you, Ante. So if the person who posted that question, if that wasn't clearly read out, can post it again or ask next time. So this is the last question. It's a general question. It says, Dear Venerable Bhante, is it possible to participate in a retreat in the forest in Sri Lanka at Nisarna Vanaya? Are females allowed to participate? Much merits. That's the end of the question.
Yeah. Yes, we are open now, and the Nisarna Vanaya, actually, even during the COVID period, it was very much closed. But now retreats are already started, and hope probably Chamila can show the retreats page. Retreats. Now, actually, our Nisarna Vanaya website shows all the available retreats scheduled for this year. So I'm trying to copy it to the chat. So you can go through this retreat schedule, and you can contact the corresponding retreat organizer, and females are allowed, allocated. And most of them, actually the participants are females, and males are also coming. And males actually have the facility to even be in the upper monastery. Females are allowed in the retreats. So it is open now. Yeah.
Okay. So that is the end of all the questions. And since we just come up on time, we will conclude the program for today. So to end the program, I would first like to thank Bhante for his valuable time and participating in this program and providing us with the guidance for the mindfulness practice and answering our questions. And also like to pass on our merits to everyone, both seen and unseen, enabling this program, and for the participants for joining the program and presenting the questions. So last of all, I'd like to thank everyone who's participated today. And sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Teruvan sannai.
Yeah, teruvan sannai.